She's the victim of a suspicious death. She's unidentified. I'm pretty sure she and, you know, anyone that's missing her would really want to know who she is.
When you get to this point in this cold case investigation, and it seems like you've tried everything that technology has to offer today, a lot of brick walls, a lot of doors slammed in your face for no apparent good reason.
Who's looking for them? Who's going to give their name?
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and executive producer of Fox's new America's Most Wanted. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, I'm super excited and really still on the edge of my seat because last week we had a returning guest and we have convinced him to tell us the rest of the story. So, Chris, please introduce yourself.
My name is Chris McMullen. I'm a detective in Bensalem, Pennsylvania.
Well, but you're more than just a detective in Bensalem, Pennsylvania. You've been a detective in Bensalem, Pennsylvania for, well, kind of a long time.
Yeah, I've been here. I've been around a while. I've been here. Right. I've been working here since 92.
Wow.
The one passion for me was the cold case homicides. And I started opening up all the cold cases that we have and trying to work on them as much as I possibly could.
Throughout. That's amazing. And last week we were talking to you about a Jane Doe who was found at the Publicler Distillery in a bunker. And she was unidentified. And
correct.
I know you said you were submitting the DNA of the fetal bones to see if that actually could get you closer to the identity of the father of that child.
Well, and in the middle of all of that, Chris, and something that's just incredible, just to remind our listeners and our Patreon subscribers that last week you told us that in the midst of trying to identify this Jane Doe at the Publicker Distillery, you managed to identify another Jane Doe who was a murder victim in New Jersey named Jeanette Tambi. And so I think it's incredible that sort of one cold case led to the identification of a victim in another cold case. And so that must have made you feel good. So after all of that, what happens next in your Jane Doe case?
It did make me feel good because it was the first time that it was the first experience I had where DNA in the CODIS system that it worked. And I said,
really?
Then I'm not stopping because all I have to do is, you know, find the right theory and get the right family reference samples and I can figure out who this girl is. So yeah, it put some wind in my sails.
That's awesome. I have to ask you, is there any way to submit it to one of the 23andMe organizations?
I tried that. In fact, right around the time.
Or genetic genealogy matches?
I wanted to do that. And I was somewhat naive to that at the time. I wasn't aware of, I don't even know if GEDmatch was on the scene yet, but that's the public DNA database.
Right.
But I actually had contacted Ancestry.com and 23andMe. I went to their websites and contact us and I hit the link and I sent an email, but I sent it on letterhead and I said, this is who I am and this is what I'm doing. And, you know, I basically got bombarded by corporate attorneys telling me that they can't do it because of privacy concerns with their clients. And I was like, no, I don't want to tell you what I was like, but I was like,
We can imagine.
Yeah.
It's a big frustration. I mean, I know, Chris, when last time we talked about, you and I met over this case and a documentary that we were filming about this, you know, that potentially involved your Jane Doe. And we were trying to get that sort of genealogy done and just kept hitting roadblock after roadblock. And right about this time, this was 2 or 3 years ago now, maybe even more like four, but sometime in 2017, I think 2016, 2017, 2018. And that was when kind of the public consciousness and all these companies were hitting and saying, wait a minute, we're handing too much DNA material over to police and to law enforcement. And people started saying, I didn't put my DNA in there in order to, you know, be arrested for the crime I committed, which, as far as I'm concerned, I say, that's just your problem, buddy. But
yeah, anyway, I would agree.
But there were all those roadblocks. They no longer wanted to cooperate with law enforcement. And it was such a huge part of solving the Golden State Killer case
right. That
happened right around
and
that same
many
time
more
period.
Since then.
Yeah,
and
that's the idea. I mean, you know, yeah. I didn't think of the idea. I saw somebody else do it and I wanted to, you know, copy it. The same thing. But I don't remember which one it was. Not only did they express privacy concerns for their clients, but one of them actually called me and said, well, you know, as far as privacy, they said, you know, you don't know if you're Jane Doe wants her DNA in there. And I said, well, she's not
seriously.
You know, I'm speaking for her, like, you know, she's the victim of a suspicious death. She's unidentified. I'm pretty sure she, you know, she and, you know, anyone that's missing her would really want to know who she is. But, you know, there I go making sense and having a moral compass.
There you go. Yeah, that's just.
Wow.
Yeah. She wanted to be anonymous and murdered and left
and
in
of bones.
Bunker. Mm-hmm. Yes. And have her baby murdered as well. So yeah, that's so ignorant.
Yeah.
So did anything come of the fetal bones? We talked about that last time. That was one of the investigative avenues you took.
Yeah. We got a partial profile that they said was suitable for comparison in the event I may have had a possible, you know, somebody I thought may have been the father. We did determine that the child was a girl. Was a female, but it was not anything that could be uploaded into the system.
And now, can you explain to us why that is, Chris? I think that was one of the things that was frustrating about this case was they said, yeah, if you ever get someone you think is the father, we can compare the profile from the fetal bones, but it's not enough of a profile to upload. I don't get that. What does that mean?
I didn't get it either. And I to this day, I never really got I'm not saying it wasn't a proper explanation. Maybe it was, but it didn't really make sense to me and it still doesn't. They said that they couldn't do that. They could only put, you know, one of the reasons was that they said it's only partial. I said, but I remember, you know, we wanted the state of California to do it. We had some reasons for that. And they wouldn't even talk to me. And to this day,
that was one of those things in the documentary is we had a person that we thought might be a suspect in the death of this young girl. And there's a DNA profile for him on file. California has it. He's an inmate literally today in California. And we just wanted to compare his DNA to the partial profile we had from the fetal bones. And California just said, not just no, but something very rude. No.
Yeah.
And why? What is their justification for that?
They didn't really have one. I mean, they just said, no, we're not going to do it. We won't allow his DNA. We won't give you the DNA, even all the little letters and numbers, the actual profile itself, not the blood or whatever they have.
Yeah, I don't get it. I was not happy, but. You know, moving.
No, so they wouldn't do it when we thought we had a viable suspect and a reason. We gave them a reason to believe that, you know, this suspect we had in California, who was in prison in California for committing a terrible murder of a young woman. And we knew he was in the area of where the Publicker distillery Jane Doe was found around the time that she would have been killed. And yet they wouldn't help us. So that was a serious frustration. Chris, so what happened next in that investigation?
We tried phenotyping, if you recall. We tried to do it with Parabon, but unfortunately, they weren't able to get a good enough DNA profile to use their technology in that. And that's literally when they used the DNA to create what the person looked like. It's kind of like what Frank Bender did in 1994, only now they're doing it with
the DNA version of it.
Yeah.
So basically, they look at the characteristics that are laid out in the DNA profile, and they build an image based on, you know, sort of the gender, the nationalities, the all the little markers that they believe have expressed in that person's DNA. And they can get eye color, they can get skin tone, they can get all sorts of things from it. And it's new and emerging technology, but it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, and I've seen a few of them, and they do have a lot of accuracy at times. I mean, it's pretty impressive. But unfortunately, it didn't work for us. And then the other test we did was isotope analysis, which is when the bones are examined and isotopes are extracted. And I'm going to try and give the layman's term of this explanation, but it has to do with water supply.
This is such an interesting technique, Chris. I remember this because it supposedly can give you a bit of a geographic history of the person. So because of the information to do with the water, they can tell sort of what area of the country the person was likely born and raised in, what kind of area they spent substantial time in, because there's differences in the water in Atlanta versus Montana versus California versus New York. And so they can give you a bit of a geographic history, which might lead you, the investigator, for example, if she had a big geographic history in Atlanta, Georgia, you could have focused potentially on missing person reports at the time in Atlanta.
Well, that's what we were doing when some of the areas that we saw that there was an indicator that she may have been there, we were going to the websites for those particular states and, you know, and just looking at their missing persons from those areas. And I remember I drafted up a letter. And I think we must have printed up 300 of them just to mail to all these agencies, like, you know, with pictures of Frank Bender's sculpture. You know, we have this Jane Doe and we're trying to figure out who she is. Unfortunately, we never got any response.
And what about the hair? I mean, aren't there markers in the hair from?
Was there any hair, though? I don't remember there being hair.
We had a fingernail and we had a little bit of hair. Yes.
Yeah.
Brown hair. Yes.
But there wasn't a lot. And if I'm not mistaken, it's been a while since I was a prosecutor, but once you take a sample, like the fingernail that you talked about, Chris, once they use it, they there may not be any more left. And so it's a real process.
Yeah.
It's a real decision. It's a weighing decision you have to make as the investigator, because once the lab takes some of that, you may never be able to do another test on it. Because you've now destroyed the evidence, you know, that part of it anyway.
Yeah, the extraction is destructive. And back then, if you recall, I was like, do it, because, you know.
You're trying to identify her.
Yeah, I'm trying to do it. So, you know, if we use up the evidence, well, so be it. But, you know, if it goes unsolved, it's not going to be for lack of trying. You know?
Right.
And so, you know, all those methods failed.
Can I ask you something, Chris, about this? This as a prosecutor, I've talked about it before on the podcast. I had a horrific gang rape case as an assistant DA right here in Cobb County. And the little girl, she was 13. The little girl's clothing was, this is so gross, so listener warning. The little girl's clothing was so covered in semen that, you know, we, of course, the police took it and sent it off to the GBI crime lab. And I was on the phone with the GBI because at the time we were still trying to identify all the suspects, and we were slowly doing it through interviews. And, you know, one person would admit that he was part of it and would turn up, you know, give us two or three other names. But there were so many people involved that we never got all the names. And so we were trying to get DNA profiles so that we could run those through all the different systems. And the crime lab came back and they said, you know, there are literally at least 100 stains on this little girl's jeans, and we cannot process them all. We will not. We won't do it. I mean, we just don't have time. It's too many resources. It's too resource intensive. And so to this day, I am haunted a decade and a half or almost two decades now later by the fact that I know we did not identify all of the people who raped that little girl. And there were at least 25 we did identify. And there were more 25. That I know we, horrific case, that I know we did not identify because the crime lab had limited resources. I'm not blaming the GBI. I love the GBI. I'm not blaming them. But the crime lab basically said, we cannot test every stain on these genes. So we're just going to take random samples. And if they match the people you've already got in custody, great. And if they don't, you know, then you deal with it. But how did you get your department, your county, your city, whatever it was, to pay for all these sort of tests? Because let's face it, phenotyping and all that, that's expensive.
That money has always been a problem because, and my department is a good department. We're well-funded, but, you know, we didn't have it in our budget for a lot of these. And I think, you know, where some of the funding came from.
Yeah, it came from the documentary people. It came from, you know, who was paying for us to make the documentary. But think about that, Chris. I mean, talk about that for a second, because I always like to give our listeners something that they can do, you know, something that they can be active about. And getting police departments funds for cold cases is really important, because these kinds of genetic tests and the phenotyping and the fetal bones, this is expensive. And most police departments can't do it.
Francie, I agree with you 100%. You're preaching to the choir here, and not to go off on a tangent, but that's, you know, talking about retirement. I've actually taken steps to form my own nonprofit to work on things like that. I know there's other ones.
That's awesome.
I know there's other ones that do it, but, you know, there's a lot of Lowe's and a lot of Home Depot's. So, you know, I'm going to give it a shot. It either works or it doesn't, but that's something I want to do.
And that's great. That's awesome. That shows your dedication to.
Well, if I'm going to retire, it's my way of keeping in it. And
there you go.
You know, but had it not been for the documentary, none of that stuff would have been done.
Yeah.
So
all those tests. Sorry, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say. So when you get to this point in this cold case investigation, and it seems like there's really, you've tried everything that technology has to offer today, a lot of brick walls, a lot of doors slammed in your face for no apparent good reason. I mean, where are you mentally about this case?
I was pretty beat up. I was very frustrated. But, you know, my outlook on it always was, you know, I will work on these cases until I retire. So, you know, I never stopped. And then I guess it was, what's it now? It was in mid-2019, I had the opportunity to try DNA genealogy with her. Mm-hmm. And again, we're talking about money. I have to, you know, my director of public safety has a good rapport with Bodie Labs, and they did that work for us. They did it pro bono.
Wow. Good for Bodie Labs. Where's that located, Chris?
I believe they're in Virginia. Yeah.
Good Bodie, for them.
They work with another lab called Othram. So they did all the laboratory work, and they were able to develop a DNA profile, and they were able to upload it to GEDmatch. And I think the other one is it's Family Tree DNA, which is also. And then I made a friend with a genealogist. You may know her name, Alan McClary. She did the genealogy work for me. And
so what exactly did she have to do?
She took the profile. She built the family tree. Once Jane Doe's profile was uploaded into GEDmatch and Family Tree DNA, you get a list of associations. Like, this might be a third degree relative, a fourth, a fifth degree. And
so it could be, there could be, I mean, 1,000, 2,000 people sort of initially, and then someone has to do a lot of, this is exactly what they did with the Golden State Killer case.
Yeah,
exactly. You have to narrow it down and get closer and closer.
It was an amazing experience for me because, you know, I'm not a genealogist, although I'd love to learn to do it if I ever, you know, find spare time. But once she actually said, okay, we're starting, I could not keep up with her. It was 4 days that we did this. And she would call me and, you know, and the thing with genealogy is, you know, you get a good lead and then you track this person down and you call if they're close enough, if they're local, you might knock on their door. But most of the time they weren't. And I would call them up. And some people like the police and want to talk to you. Some people tell you to go to hell. You know, they don't want to talk to you. But we had a first cousin and from Pennsylvania, from the Pocono area. I call her up. I tell her who I am, what's going on. Nicest woman in the world. Eager to help.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
She's like,
that's awesome.
I'd love to help you, but I was adopted and I don't know my biological family.
Oh, you're joking.
I'm like, you know, of course you don't. I mean, I've talked to her since. I mean, she's a great person, but I was, you know, with the luck of this case, of course that's the case.
No. You know?
Unbelievable.
So you find out now that the first cousin of your Jane Doe was actually adopted, and she doesn't know her own true identity.
No.
Wow. Oh,
she doesn't know any of her. So,
and well, are you able to dig
you
back?
You must have been ready to jump off
records?
A building.
I was frustrated. What was that, Jim? I'm sorry.
Are you able to go back and get her adoption records? Is there any way that can be solved?
We talked about that, but the legalities in that would have been time consuming. And I just, you know, I spoke with Yolanda and it was like, okay, we're just, you know, we hit a detour. We're going to, you know,
keep going.
Going to bypass, you know.
Right.
Wow.
And she just, you know, she was at it morning, noon, and night, her and her partner working on this. And, I remember it was mid-January of this year. It was a Friday. And she called me up. She said, check your email. I said, okay. She said,
exciting.
I sent you two names.
Two names.
Linda Todd and Joseph Todd. They're from Philadelphia. I said, okay. She said, Jane Doe is their sister.
Get out of here.
Seriously?
Seriously. I said, I love Yolanda. She's great, but I was just like, okay.
Could
it be that simple? Could she really be from Philadelphia? Which was my theory all along. I said, okay. Now it's Friday night. It's like 8 o'clock. It's raining. And I'm like, well, Philadelphia, Philadelphia's right there. You know, I started looking up the names. And, you know, I'm checking various databases that we use. I'm checking our in-house computer. Do we have any contact with these people? No, we didn't. Okay. I need addresses and phone numbers. So I start coming up with them.
Hey.
They only live like 15 minutes away.
And you get in your car, God. Don't you?
Is your heart like pounding? Are you excited or are you just kind of like, this could also be a dead end?
Both, because yeah, I'm not going to lie. My heart's pounding. I'm like, son of a bitch, we're solving it. We're solving it tonight. And then I'm like, take a step back. Don't get your hopes up. Just, you know, right. Slow it down. So I couldn't find a working number for either Linda or Joseph, but I started doing my own little family tree and I found a phone number and an email address for Joseph's daughter. So I fire her off an email and I call her. But people, when they see, you know, like Ben Salem Township come up on their phone, oh God, the cops are calling me. They don't, you know, they, right. They don't answer the phone. They don't know the number or they think it's a bill right. collector alone. You know. So I texted her from my cell phone. I said, this is who I am. There's absolutely no dire emergency. Now. I mean, you know, but I would really like to talk to you. Could you please call me? I think her name was Kristen. Really nice girl. She calls me back like not even half an hour later.
Oh.
Calls me back. She is Joseph's daughter. Young girl. Probably in her late teens, early 20s. So I said, listen, I thank you for calling me back. And I this is who I am. This is why I reached out to you. And I lay it all out for her.
Mm.
I mean, you know, Reader's Digest version, but I lay the whole thing out. And I said, with all of that being said, did your dad ever have a sister that vanished? And I get like a little bit of a pregnant pause and I can hear her thinking, you know, she, yeah, he did. I fell out of my chair.
Wow.
Oh, Chris.
She says he had a sister that disappeared in 1985.
Wow.
Oh my God.
And I said, what was her name? And she said, Lisa.
Lisa Todd.
You must have wanted to cry.
I did. I was actually like, I was so overcome with emotion. You know, it was 2020. I'd been working on the case for 18 years at the time. And I was just like, Lisa Todd. I said, all right. I said, where's your father at? She said, he's on his way home from work. I said, I need to speak with your dad. I said, give him my number. 20 minutes later, give or take, I get a phone call from Joseph. Really nice guy. He's very upset. He says, you found my sister. I said, yeah, I think I did.
Oh my God, Chris.
I said, look, what we need to talk. Why don't I come down and see you? So my partner and I, he gave us his address. We shot down and we sat with him and we spoke with him. And, he told us the whole story. And, I showed him photographs of the jewelry that were found with her and he recognized the rings.
Did he have pictures of her?
We did get a picture of her and, you know, bringing the conversation full circle. When we talk about Parabon snapshots and how accurate they were, I will put Frank Bender's old fashioned work against that because she really, I'll send you guys the picture and you can decide.
Wow. But can we post them both?
Sure.
Oh yeah. Send them to me, Chris. I'd love to post them so our people can see them.
And now the picture we have of Lisa was when she was 14. Now, you know, she died when she was 17. So she was a little older, but as soon as I saw the picture, I said, son of a bitch, man, Frank Bender was right on.
Wow.
So, and you know, I met with Joseph, I met with the sister Linda and then, really nice family, great people. And what I had found out was that when Lisa disappeared, she already had a 2-year-old son.
Oh
my God. She was only 17.
We became friends and he was, you know, this was a guy that his whole life thought that maybe his mother had abandoned him. And so he, you know, but after, you know, he and I talked and,
you know,
you know, so he got some closure. I mean, he even invited me to the funeral, which I went to, by the way.
Wow. So Chris,
they had a funeral for her.
Yeah. So Chris,
he took her home. He lives in another state and he took her home with him. So
awesome. But I have to ask, have you any leads on who the father was or who the killer was or how she died?
Yes, yes, and yes. And that's still active.
Okay.
This time.
All right. And, well, that means one, I don't think you're retiring until you resolve that. And two, we need to get you back on when you do solve that.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right. I hope that we do solve it. And I am working on some things, and we actually have another Jane Doe case that we are working on right now.
Oh, geez, Chris, you're a glutton for punishment. I want to go back to Lisa for a second. It just must have been an incredible moment for you to know her name, this girl that you've been searching.
She finally had her name, you know, and I think.
When you did that, Chris, you did that. You gave her name back.
Thank you. I mean, it wasn't just me. It was everybody. It was Yolanda. It was Bodhi Labs. It was you and your people. It was everybody that helped along the way. It was just, I just refused to let the case die.
Well, that's why it's you. Jim and I have talked about
organized
on this podcast,
all these people.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim and I have talked about a few weeks ago. We talked about, you know, we've been talking about the Brian Laundrie, Gabby Petito case, and that led us to discover this Wyoming task force of indigenous missing and murdered women. And it just brings to bear again a point that I find sort of remarkable, that you have missing women, missing children in far higher numbers than like missing men somehow. And yet, you know, who's looking for them? Who's going to give their name? Like, you gave Lisa back hers. And I feel like this is just such an important issue. We have so many people. I mean, because I know that in addition to Jeanette Tambi and you giving her back her name, you also solved a cold case of another woman whose name everyone knew, but had no idea what happened to her. And that was Donna Dickey, who had died a horrible, brutal death, you know, in the same area because of the work of you and the other police department. Because of this suspect we thought we had in this documentary. I mean, Chris, this is just amazing work. I have to say, I think you deserve an award. I know you're not looking for it. I think you deserve an award. I think this goes to show you how difficult police work is, especially when it's cold cases. And I agree with Jim. I want you to come back when this case is officially solved and you have someone in custody, and hopefully that will happen. Although I do want you to talk about how difficult an investigation like this is when you have bones and no cause of death.
Yeah, that's, the fact that the cause and manner were listed as undetermined. I disagree with that. If you the totality and, you know, some of the things I'm not going to go into at this time, but
I think, this is a perfect case for an equivocal death investigation. And you may, now that you know her, you may be able to do that and figure out, you know, where she was in her life. And that, at the results of those equivocal death investigations, can sometimes change the manner of death determination.
Yeah, it's my goal to have it changed to homicide by unspecified means.
Well, and you do not have to comment on this, Chris, because we don't want to screw up your investigation, of course, at all. But I mentioned, it might've been last week, I can't remember when I mentioned it, whether it was this week or last week, but I mentioned the report, a study that had just come out that said the leading cause of death for pregnant women is homicide. What I didn't mention was that the perpetrator is almost always the father of the child. I'm not saying that's the case in your case, Chris, but I think it is an interesting thing. And I'm sure as a trained investigator, you're at least thinking about that possibility. And I look forward to the day when you can bring whoever might have played a role in Lisa Todd's death to justice.
As do I.
That would be awesome. Well, Chris, I have to tell you, at least two times during the last episode here, I got chills from the revelations that you made, and also from the fact that you were able to give this man his mother's remains and to actually let him know that she didn't voluntarily leave him, I mean, to me, that is one of the most important things in law enforcement officers' careers, is that the help that you provided him, because you were relentless, literally changed his life.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I know other people who are in that situation where they don't know what happened to their mother. And it can really affect you for your entire life.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, with any case I've had or cold cases, you know, at the end of the day, I would like to think that we made a positive difference in someone's life, you know, whether it was a victim of a crime, but you know, they got through it and justice was served, or these cold cases where, you know, families that had zero answer, zero closure, whether they have a complete sense of that, or at least they have, you know, a partial idea to try and give them, you know, some type of peace. You know, I mean, I always equate it to the starfish story. You know, I don't know if you ever heard the starfish story.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, it's a poem. I didn't write it. I read it somewhere, but I'll give you the real fast version, but there's a beach and there was a big storm. And after the storm, there's thousands of starfish washed up on the beach. And there's this young boy and he's walking along and he's picking up starfish and he's throwing them back into the water. And this elderly scholar comes along, this elderly gentleman, he says, you know, young man, what are you doing? And he says, oh, I'm throwing the starfish back into the water so they don't die. And the man says to him, he says, young man, look at this beach. There are thousands of starfish here. You're not going to make a difference. And with that, the kid picks up another starfish, throws it in the water, and he says, I made a difference to that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And yeah. I heard that in elementary school.
Mm.
Or wow. Not maybe high school. It was before I was in police work. I just think it's the coolest.
Yeah.
I just think it's such
the antidote for cynicism, right?
It is. I mean, exactly right. You know, that's a good way to put it. You
know? So, you know, Lisa's a starfish, you know,
And so is Jeanette. And so is Donna.
Barbara. I mean,
you were able to help a number of families get to a position where they at least knew, they at least understood better what happened. And that helps people move on and go on living and resolve issues that they thought they had that they didn't really have.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. At the end of the day, when I retire, I want to be able to say, well, you know what? I think I did some good. And you know, hopefully
you did. You definitely did, Chris. This is just
absolutely.
This is just incredible. Jim, this has been an incredible two episodes, I have to say.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris, for the work you did and do every day and continue to do in the Bensalem Police Department as a detective, as an experienced detective, as an old timer now.
Yeah.
Season, Jim. It's season.
And no, but what I want to say is I'm sure there's police officers, and young detectives in your department and in the other departments that you have touched during these investigations that look at you and say, wow, I want to be Chris Mullen when I grow up. I want to be that kind of detective.
I just hope that, you know, cases don't go cold. And if there are other, you know, I just hope that somebody would, you know, pick up where I leave off whenever, you know, because we're next to Philly and Philly gets, you know, has so much more crime, but you know, we have our share of crime here, but I refuse to believe that we have enough crime where we should have cases going cold.
Right.
You're absolutely right. It's one of the things that drives me. I don't want to go on a political rant, but it drives me crazy. You know, you can talk about governments and wasteful spending. This would be good spending. We have the money in this country to find answers for people who've gone missing. We know we can do it. It just requires resources. I mean, not every department, in fact, very few departments have a Chris McMullen who are going to spend 20 years obsessing over a case and going the extra mile to try to find Lisa Todd's name. And just thank you for telling us all about this, Chris.
I have been accused of being obsessed and I don't deny it. That's okay. Well, I can live with that.
You know? Well, I think the best law enforcement officers are always a bit obsessed.
Yeah. And you're one of them. Well, one of the best law enforcement officers is what I was saying. 100%. Not necessarily obsessed. Chris, thank you so much for coming on Best Case, Worst Case, and for really enlightening our listeners as to so many of the ins and outs and trials and tribulations of doing cold case work. I know I did it for a while in Washington, D.C. There were way too many unsolved homicides. Yeah. And it was really rewarding to be able to solve some of them and to get some real justice for the victims. So, as I said before, we want you to keep coming back to talk about this and other cases. And until next time, thank you to our listeners and viewers. And this is Best Case, Worst Case, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gerbel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.